Coming up.
You know what? I just want to give it to you verbatim here. It says his remark was not intended to be a factual statement.
Is truth no longer valued in politics?
He's not lying to get out of a commitment like jury duty or to be boastful. He's standing on the Senate floor lying to the American people to get his way.
Haven't politicians always been liars?
You're saying it's a falsehood and they're giving alternative facts.
With so much fake news and alternative facts going around, how can we know what is true anymore?
One person's fake news is another person's news.
Is the post-truth era an inevitable result of the internet age?
What do I know about it? All I know is what's on the internet.
Have we entered an era of epistemic nihilism?
What does he mean when he says words?
How can we combat lies in the post-truth era?
Our guest is Christopher Myers, editor of A Philosophical Approach to Journalism Ethics.
Post-truth politics.
Just the facts, ma'am.
Coming up on Philosophy Talk.
Why is politics today so full of lies?
And who's to blame for all the lies? The politicians? The media? Or we, the consumers?
Can we philosophers of all people help to find a way out of this mess?
Welcome to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Josh Landy.
And I'm Ken Taylor. We're here at the studios of KALW San Francisco.
Continuing conversations that begin at Philosopher's Corner on the Stanford campus, where Ken teaches philosophy, and I teach Comp Lit, as well as co-directing the Literature and Philosophy Initiative.
So, Josh, I'd like to officially welcome you to the co-host chair.
Thanks a lot, Ken. I'm really delighted to join the team.
And for all you John fans out there, John has graduated to host emeritus, but he'll be joining us again from time to time in many different ways.
Today, we're thinking about post-truth politics.
Man, this is a timely topic, Josh.
No kidding. When it comes to the status of truth in public discourse, these really are the worst of times.
Well, I don't know about that. I mean, that's a little too strong. It's always been terrible.
Well, what are you talking about? You've got a president repeating conspiracy theories. Huge percentages of the population think Obama is a Muslim. Spokespeople are talking about alternative facts or are telling us straight up facts don't exist anymore. I mean, things have never been worse, Ken.
Look, I'm not denying that's all bad, really bad. But please, let's not be prisoners of the present moment. Go back to ancient Athens, the Greek flourishing of democracy. Aspiring power mongers back then, well, they would go study with the sophists. Sophists were professional liars. They would teach people a bunch of clever argumentative strategies to make the weaker argument the stronger, as Plato put it. They were just good for bamboozling people, though. Politicians have never, ever, Josh, given a hoot about the truth.
Look, I like to think that things got a little better in the intervening 2,500 years.
Oh, really? So when is this paradise that you're so nostalgic for?
Well, how about the Enlightenment?
Oh, come on. What about the Enlightenment?
Well, look, you're a fan of Kant. I am, too. I mean, didn't that guy do some pretty powerful championing of truth, autonomy, and free and independent thought?
Look, he's one of my favorites, but Josh, he was just a philosopher, a mere philosopher. We're talking about politics and politicians.
Sure, but some of that Enlightenment thinking percolated out. I mean, think of the First Amendment. And what about the rise of democracy? I mean, that changed things completely.
Oh, Josh, you bought into all this million stuff that the democracy creates a marketplace of ideas free from top-down control where truth can flourish. You bought into all that, right?
Well, I mean, look, you know, the ideas that get believed in a democracy, they're the ones that are backed by the best arguments, not the ones that have the most powerful authorities behind them.
Josh, where have you been? How did you get to be such an idealist? Haven't you heard of, like, manufactured consent?
Oh, I see. You're with Chomsky. You think the mass media work is a kind of propaganda tool for the big corporations.
That's exactly what I think. And your supposedly free marketplace of ideas get bought and sold by massive corporate interests. And boom, there goes your free independent thinking. There goes your concern for truth right down the drain.
Look, I totally agree that manufactured consent is a bad thing, but come on, things are even worse now, right?
Oh, how could they be? What are you talking about?
Well, manufactured consent was at least hidden. Now people are lying brazenly and out in the open. I mean, think about Donald Trump claiming he had the largest inauguration crowd of all time.
No fair, Josh. You're playing the Trump card on me? Gosh, okay, you're right about that. And, you know, it's not just politicians. It's the news outlets, too.
Yeah, right. Now you're getting it, Ken. And the reason those news outlets can get away with that nonsense is because we abandoned the fairness doctrine, that rule that required news channels to be honest, equitable, and balanced.
And don't forget about the profit motive. Just, you can't forget about that one.
No, I agree. I mean, when the media place profit margins above honesty, we've got a big problem.
Well, look, okay, one saving grace. This is philosophy talk. Philosophers, we're still holdouts for the truth.
Ha! You sure about that?
What do you mean, Josh?
Well, how about our former colleague, Richard Rorty? Didn't he say that science is no truer than Scientology, just more useful? Didn't he say the very idea of a fact of the matter is one we'd be better off without?
Gosh, Josh, first you play the Trump card, and now you're playing the Rorty card. You keep fighting dirty. But look, but surely you can't believe that philosophers single-handedly created this mess.
No, no, no. Of course they didn't. Now, people like Rorty didn't dig the hole. I'm just saying they're not the ones who are going to pull us out of it.
Yeah, okay, Rorty's not and his brethren, but other philosophers can't. I mean, people like you and me. Look, I don't mean to brag or anything or toot my own horn, but I can educate people to tell the difference between truth, lies, and what Harry Frankfurt called BS. I can make students allergic to bad arguments. I can get them to see through a piece of nonsense in like 2 seconds flat.
Ken, everyone should take your classes. In the meantime, we should probably try to figure out how we ended up in this post-truth era. We sent our roving philosophical reporter, Holly J. McDeed, to explore some of the legends and conspiracy theories that have shaped our country's political landscape. She files this report.
You ever seen a Bigfoot? Or maybe even a skunk ape?
I have.
As it's known? You have? You've seen a Bigfoot?
I have, yes. I've had a personal experience with one, yes.
This is an excerpt of the podcast Beautiful Anonymous.
What's the craziest thing our government's hiding from us that you believe to be real?
Random strangers call in, and comedian Chris Gethard talks to whoever's on the other end for an hour.
You know, I'm not an alien believer, but I am a conspiracy theorist.
In what sense?
I'm a believer that we were the ones who flew the planes into the Trade Center towers, that we set up the Boston bombing, that we set up different shootings in schools, and things like that.
I will say, when you bring up 9/11, the Boston bombings and school shootings, I think that is probably the line in the sand that many of our listeners just went, nah, not into this. No longer into this guy.
Or at least about half might not be into it. American listeners, at least. The other half, they do believe the government is hiding something about 9/11. That's according to the Chapman University Survey of American Fears. Almost as many think that the JFK assassination was rigged. So maybe it's not surprising that the Oxford English Dictionary declared the 2016 word of the year was post-truth. George W. Bush's senior advisor, Karl Rove, paved the way for this when he criticized what he called the reality-based community in 2005. But our perception of truthiness dates back much farther than Bush Jr.
Yeah, the idea of a post-truth era implies there was a truth era, and that's just not true.
Jesse Walker is the author of The United States of Paranoia, a conspiracy theory. He says we've always been a nation of conspiracy lovers. Take, for example, the Puritans, who arrived in this country in the 1600s, eager to build a new world from scratch, armed with some hardcore and some might say creative beliefs, like that the wilderness itself was involved in a conspiracy to destroy them. American paranoia was still around in the late 1850s, when Republican writer John Smith Dye suggested Southern agents had poisoned lump sugar in an attempt to assassinate President-elect James Buchanan.
And it's very similar to the sorts of stories that you would hear about, you know, the deaths of John F. Kennedy, Bobby Kennedy, Martin Luther King, the attempted assassination of George Wallace. They're not just something that only appeared at that recent moment that we remember. They come up again and again and again.
Kurt Anderson took a look at the more recent history of so-called truth in his new book, Fantasyland, How America Went Haywire, a 500-year history. Jumping ahead to the 1960s, Christian evangelists, hippies, and intellectuals began embracing the Puritan notion of creating one's own truth. And psychiatrists even suggested mental illness was just another way to see reality, that it was all relative.
Which is to say that no one way of defining what is real and what is not real and what is true and what is not true is superior to any other. So science is not superior to magic.
By the same token, untethered Americans became free to believe in UFOs, that the moon landing was an elaborate hoax, and by the 1990s, that pro wrestling can be both real and make-believe.
People were willing to accept simultaneously that it wasn't real, but that they could be crazily passionate about it. And it didn't matter anymore if it was fake or real or both.
So it made sense to Anderson, the same celebrity who would make guest appearances on semi-real, semi-fake pro wrestling matches, later became the face of today's post-truth era.
I can't mention the WWE without noting that Donald Trump himself was a WWE performer as well as impresario and has been enshrined in the WWE Hall of Fame.
It is time for the battle!
Now alternative facts are real. The media is the enemy. Anderson is worried that we may be stuck forever in fantasy land, that the dreams that practically build America may also destroy us.
I think the best we can hope for is that we will not become untethered from reality any more than we are right now.
Look at it from this perspective. The Declaration of Independence consisted mostly of a conspiracy theory that a king was out to enslave American subjects. And without that conspiracy theory, our country's democracy might not exist. And it does exist, right? Asking for a friend. For Philosophy Talk, I'm Holly J. McDeed.
You mean the moon landing wasn't an elaborate hoax? Thanks for that, Holly. I'm Ken Taylor. With me is my Stanford colleague, Josh Landy, and today we're talking about post-truth politics.
We're joined now by Christopher Myers. He is Professor Emeritus of Philosophy at California State University, Bakersfield, where he's also Director Emeritus of the Kegley Institute of Ethics, and he's the editor of A Philosophical Approach to Journalism Ethics. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Christopher.
Thank you, guys. It's a joy to be here.
So, Christopher, this is no doubt a fascinating topic, but I got to admit, it's kind of a depressing one. I don't like to think about depressing topics. So tell me, what got you interested in thinking so much about this depressing topic?
It is a depressing topic, especially if you really care about journalism and you really care about democracy. I've been doing journalism ethics for over 30 years. And once upon a time, I spent most of my time criticizing journalism. Now I find myself having to defend it, given the horror show that we've been seeing for the last 2 to 3 years.
So it sounds like you agree with me that things we really are in the worst of times, at least in recent memory.
Certainly within recent memory. Things are more ideological, more profit-driven, and there's more access to information than there's ever been before. But if you go back far enough, certainly journalism has had its problems since its very beginning.
I think it was in a piece of yours. I was reading about the treatment of poor Abe Lincoln by the journalists. I mean, they were savage and one-sided and brutal to the man. So journalism, come on. I mean, go back. There's recent memory and then there's not that long ago.
Yeah, what was really interesting about that research is much of the criticism came from the Northern papers. And even the Emancipation Proclamation, they declared it to be usurpation of power. We were all going to be under the hand of a dictator tomorrow. Very similar to the kinds of things that President Obama faced.
So is it different today, or is it basically just a continuation?
It's different today than it was 40, 50 years ago. And I think it's different in that there's so much more widespread information, and so much of that, particularly internet-based, doesn't seem to have the commitment to the standards of journalism. It's driven by ideology. It's driven by politics rather than driven by let's get accurate information and you do it for a public service.
So I mean, it sounds like you say, you make a distinction. I want you to just elaborate a little bit. You say it's different than it was 40 or 50 years ago, but that seems to imply that before that, it was different still, as if we go through some kind of cycle, as if there's a complicated history of this. Am I reading you right?
There's certainly a complicated history. I don't know whether there's cycles here. But go back to yellow journalism of the 20s and 30s and early 40s. Arguably, Hearst started the Spanish-American War so that he could sell newspapers. He was at a huge circulation fight in New York. Now, hopefully, Mr. Trump is not going to be using propaganda fake news to send us off to North Korea. So things certainly have been bad for a long time. But journalism has always been the check against that kind of craziness, at least in the last 50 years, has been the check against that craziness from the politicians.
But what I'm wondering is there times when in the history of America or the developed, industrialized, so-called democratic world in which journalism is more like propaganda and then less like it and then more like it? I mean,
absolutely. The original notion of journalism was propaganda. It was all of the papers were partisan. They were ideological. They were driven by trying to promote the political agenda of their party. It's only been since arguably the early 40s that journalism has thought of itself as providing a kind of objective, neutral standard.
So we need to dig into this. It sounds like really fascinating and complicated stuff. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Today, we're thinking about post-truth politics with Christopher Myers from CSU Bakersfield.
In our next segment, we'll ask how we got into this mess we're in. Who's to blame for post-truth politics? Politicians? The media? Or we the people?
The Holy Trinity. Lying politicians, fake news, and very gullible people. Plus, your calls and emails when Philosophy Talk continues. So we've been living in a post-truth era at least since John Lennon became a post-Beatle. But what can we do about it now? I'm Ken Taylor. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Josh Landy, and we're thinking about post-truth politics. Our guest is Christopher Myers from CSU Bakersfield, editor of A Philosophical Approach to Journalism Ethics.
So, Christopher, it seems that we all agree that we're kind of in a trough of post-truthiness. I mean, it may come and go, but we're in a pretty low state right now, much worse than when John Lennon wrote that song.
Yes.
However long ago that was. How did we get here? How did we get to this point?
Yeah, so at least a couple of primary causes. The first, I think, is, as Josh noted, the canceling of the Fairness Doctrine. That allowed particularly talk radio to start to dominate the right-wing conversation, and that changed the very way that journalists started thinking about what are issues and what are facts.
I don't really recall. I think I was too young to care or too unreflective to care.
That was 1987.
I know. What drove people in politics? I mean, that's an FCC regulation. What drove the FCC to abandon that? What was going on that people said, well, we don't need that anymore?
Well, it was Reagan's FCC that dropped it. And the folks on the right strongly believed, obviously they still do, that so-called mainstream media was far too left-leaning and they needed to open up, create freedom of airwaves in a style different than the corporate media had.
So to put a positive spin on that, they were thinking, I'm going to put it maybe in their voices, they were thinking that the FCC was interfering with the free marketplace of ideas that Josh and Mill are so fond of, and that this gives us a place for the free market of ideas to work. So right-wing ideas should be allowed to flourish and allowed to speak in their voice, and you're preventing that.
Right, except that the government owns the airwaves. So it's not like I can pick up a radio station somewhere and just start broadcasting and override this particular station, for example, on the air. They get to control who's going to own those channels and who's going to talk on them, which was the whole point of the Fairness Doctrine.
Yeah, but I'm still not seeing the point for the Fairness Doctrine yet, because I'm going back to the free marketplace of ideas. That's like a kind of the government insisting that the discourse that takes place in my airways has to be structured thusly.
Well,
it
has to be two-sided. But we're talking about news, right? I mean, you can broadcast your opinion, but if you want to present something as news, doesn't it make sense to have a requirement that it actually resemble the fact?
That's like a presupposing that we know who the facts are. Who's the arbiter of the facts? Isn't discourse the arbiter of the fact? And if I'm the right-wing guy, you get to have your left-wing station, you get to have your centrist station, and the people get to listen to us both, and maybe there's some station that brings us together to argue together. But I still don't see why the demise of the Fairness Doctrine. I could see an argument that it creates a marketplace of ideas that's unrestrained and unrestricted, and that's when truth is supposed to flourish. Obviously, truth hasn't flourished, but what's the flaw in that thinking?
Yeah, so again, the access to that structure, the airwaves, is a key piece of this. But even Mill argued that it's not unlimited discourse. There does have to be some structure. If you recall, at the beginning of Chapter 3, after long conversations about the importance of free speech and free expression and character, he immediately says, of course, we're not talking about a mob out in front of a corn dealer's house.
Right.
So even the most avid proponents of free speech think there has to be a mechanism that keeps people from falsely yelling fire in a crowded theater.
Okay. So I want to go back to Josh, because I don't want to put words in Josh's mouth. But I think he thinks that intellectuals, especially sort of POMO, new left intellectuals, and their unconcern for truth play at least as important a role in the rise of post-truth politics as a regulatory regime like the abandonment of the fairness. Do I have you roughly?
Yeah, I wouldn't go that far, but I think that the abandonment of the fairness doctrine did much bigger damage. But it is an interesting question I'd like to ask you, Christopher. I mean, you know, Daniel Dennett has claimed that, right, that the postmodernists actually helped to create this environment of cynicism about truth and facts. And Kurt Anderson, who was quoted in the report, the Roving Philosophical Report, said that postmodern intellectuals were useful idiots for the American right. Do you think that's right?
I certainly think postmodernism contributed to it. I actually think currently a bigger problem is the identity politics and identity teaching that's so dominant in the university. The idea that we really cannot access, understand the point of view, the importance, the values of folks who come from different backgrounds, different perspectives, that there's no way to bridge the conversational gap or the epistemological gaps. That strikes me as, again, fully feeding into, well, from my point of view, the inauguration was the biggest ever. You know, you guys just don't see it the way I do.
Well, right. So this thing that you're referring to, I think, goes under the name in some circles of standpoint epistemology, right, which is a major movement in philosophical circles, one I'm not a complete fan of, but I'm going to speak a little bit on behalf of it. Because with the idea of standpoint epistemology is not a anti-truth thing, not in its core. It's just that there are certain truths that are only accessible to people situated a certain way.
Yes.
So that an elite, wealthy white guy cannot understand the true nature of the oppression of a marginalized, impoverished black guy, and that I have, as a marginalized, impoverished black guy, let us say, I have a kind of epistemic privilege, privileged epistemic access to certain facts that you lack, and so I should get to speak, and you should listen. I mean, there's some plausibility to that.
Yeah, that you have privileged access doesn't mean you have unique access. That if you really do understand what this particular point is, and if you're good at what you do, and you obviously are, you should be able to explain it to me. I'm not, you know, an idiot, and I don't have such strict barriers in front of my eyes that if you do your job well, if you teach, then you should be able to help me to understand it, at least at a sufficiently deep level.
I agree with that, and I can see why a standpoint epistemology might look like a problem in this context. But, you know, the counter argument that one usually hears is, well, look, you know, aren't we talking mostly here about right-wing news stations? Whereas the postmodernists and the people who push for standpoint epistemology, they tend to be people on the left. So why should we think that there's a carryover from what's happening on the intellectual left to what's happening on the political right?
You're evidently not reading enough Facebook. Take the protests in Berkeley a couple of weeks ago. The left-wing Facebook analysis of that protest was so different than the mainstream media's, let alone the right-wing version of it. The discourse on the left is very dominant among social media, and there are plenty of internet sites that promulgate that same ideology and that same approach to these problems. And they're not talking to the folks on the right.
So wait a minute, though. Okay, I want to get a color here, but I want to... Well, maybe we should get the caller, and then I'll key up another question. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We'd love to have you join this conversation. And we've got Lisa from San Francisco's on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Lisa.
Yeah, thank you so very much. It is a really interesting conversation. I just want to point out that media has been participating in collusion with the government for quite some time, including during the Bush lead-up to the Iraq War. They basically had no doubt that somehow or another, you know, Iraq had weapons of mass destruction, which it didn't. And also this issue of so-called fairness. I agree that the fairness doctrine was a shame that it was gotten rid of, but the media turned it on its head when it tried to provide equal importance to the climate change debate, as if there really was a debate, when 99% of the scientists believe that there was definitely a human-generated effect on climate change, which we are seeing right now. And with respect to the protest in Berkeley, I'm going to tell you something. I'm part of that same Facebook left that your guest mentioned, because to tell you the truth, the KKK did lynch people. The Nazis did kill people. So in essence, a defense of our communities and a defense basically of reality is really warranted, because the media seems to be putting as if it was equal, as if people that were defending themselves were equal to the ones who are actually propagating violence against a whole entire group of people based on our beliefs.
Lisa, you raised a lot of really good points, and I'm going to try and give our guest a respond. Thanks a lot for the call. So, Christopher, there's a lot in what Lisa said. I'll pick out whatever you want to respond to.
Quickly, a couple of things. There's no question that some of the core media outlets, New York Times being the most infamous, helped lead us into the Iraq War. But at the same time, there was plenty of criticism from many mainstream outlets about the arguments leading up to the war.
Wait a minute, but slow down. I do think, I know there's a lot more in Lisa's, but I want to pause on this. I do think the media during that time abandoned its station to be a clarion as a collectivity. I mean, there were differences among them. But taken in aggregate, they kind of abandoned their station of being a skeptical clarion call to say what is true and what is fact and what. And it's like they kind of serve the rallying the nation function way, way too much.
I don't think they – I wouldn't give you that they – rallied too much. But journalists are humans too. And this is shortly after 9/11. The nation is still in grief and mourning, trying to rally around some common themes. I remember being in a newsroom when the U.S. accidentally shot down the Iraq jetliner back in the mid-'80s, late-'80s. And the journalists were so horrified that this could happen, they weren't willing to consider that it could have been the U.S. who did it. They have the same sense of patriotism, of commitment to country. And of course, from their epistemological standpoint, that's going to feed into how they understand these
problems.
But
that's when they owe us, that's when they owe it to not abandon their station, to not give in to the ordinary human temptation, because they're in a different role.
And give them a little bit of time, and they will eventually get there, as happened with the Iraq War. The media certainly turned against the Iraq War pretty quickly.
I'd agree with that. Maybe we can turn to another part of Lisa's question about false equivalences.
Yeah.
I mean, so there's a big question here about what the responsibility is of news stations and journalists. I mean, what does it mean to be fair?
Yeah, so part of the old objectivity standard was some notion of a mirror on the world. We are going to accurately capture what's happening out there and simply reflect it to our viewers and listeners and readers. Journalists realized pretty quickly that that's an impossible standard, so they went to balance instead. So long as we're presenting both sides of the story in a fair way, of course, there are a gazillion sides to any complex story. And so merely calling it the two sides already undercuts it.
See, the thing that bothers me about journalism and that is not that per se, but that they're really bad at it, because presenting two sides is one thing. That's easy. That's lazy. I can present two sides. But interrogating two sides, that's hard. That takes work. And that's what many of them, especially broadcast journalists, are very bad at doing, is interrogating these two sides, because they're unprepared, their knowledge is shallow, it's 24-hour news cycle. You would think they have time to dig deep, but they don't.
Oh, well, yeah, of course they don't have time to dig deep, and they're not trained to do that. And these days there are fewer and fewer and fewer of them doing more and more and more work. They don't have time to go out and research all of this. The climate change example, I think, is the perfect one where journalists really did start to come to recognize you can't present a story as if the deniers are equivalent to the scientists.
Right.
And the equivalency of the Nazis and Antifa or any other group protesting them, that, of course, is also a crazy false equivalency.
So we haven't dug into all of Lisa's issues. There was one more. But I didn't want to get another caller in here. Joe from Petaluma. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Joe.
Thanks. I feel like, as we all know, words and information can convey different things. They can convey, obviously, facts and statistics, but there's also emotional truths, there's moral truths, and certainly many others. And I think what I see, at least when I watch news programs, whether it's NPR or Fox News, is they're very concerned with the very surface facts, statistics, but they lose that sense of emotional truth, of moral truth. And so I think it's easy to watch those programs and you see one person with talking points and, their PR manager waiting in the wings, talking to another person. And they may be giving some facts, some statistics, some truth, but I think on a more visceral level, you get the impression that they're just morally and emotionally maybe disingenuous. And somebody like Donald Trump, even though he is a compulsive liar, when he stands up in front of the Republican debate platform and he says, oh, it's all rigged, that is very truthful.
Yeah, Joe.
It resonates.
Joe, I get where you're going. It's an excellent question. Christopher, what do you think? Real quick, we're going to be into a break, but
You're asking for way too much from journalism. If you want them to convey facts, emotional truth, moral truth, Trump, no doubt, very successfully tied into our guts very early on. And that's why those of us who rely more on our brains just didn't see it coming. Journalists can't do it all.
Yeah, I see what you're saying to Joe, but I feel his pain. I really do feel his pain. Journalists can't do it all, but the media collectively can do it all, can interrogate the real cost and benefits, the upside and downside, and the real losers, can display the consequences. I mean, the media collectively, this little anchor can't do that all, but...
Well, you do
These
have
her whole posse.
I mean, don't forget that journalism obviously is a house of many rooms, and you have fact checkers, you have op-ed writers. I mean, I feel like some values can at least come in through the op-ed page, for example.
Certainly, you can get values through the op-ed page through good news analysis that's increasingly showing up on the front page, and you can get it from multiple sources. When we get to ways to counteract this, part of my argument is going to be that we, the consumers, have to be seeking information from various sources.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're thinking about post-truth politics with Christopher Myers from CSU Bakersfield.
Is there anything we can do to resist post-truth politics? How do we stop the spread of fake news? And how can we make sure we're not taken in by it?
Resisting post-truth politics when Philosophy Talk continues. For some politicians, lying is like an automatic habit. But what can we do when their supporters won't see through them? I'm Ken Taylor, and this is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Josh Landy. Our guest is Christopher Myers from CSU Bakersfield, and we're thinking about post-truth politics.
So, Christopher, we're going to do something that we do in on Philosophy Talk from time to time. We're going to make you czar of the world.
Awesome.
And you get to help us find our way out of this epistemic nihilism. What do you do?
Yes. Yeah,
so what's the first thing you do?
The first thing I do is to recommend some patience. The marketplace of ideas, I'm in Josh's camp. I still believe it works, but it doesn't work tomorrow. It takes time for these ideas to filter, for the crud to slough off and for the better ideas to rise. One of the ways, two of the ways that can happen, journalism has to recommit to being a public service. In the 80s and 90s, when they were making money hand over fist, they bought each other out, they got into huge debt, then the recessions hit, and they just couldn't sustain that economic model anymore. They have to recommit to public service, not just to making a profit. And then we have to go to different sources. I force myself to listen to AM talk radio on a regular basis so I know what the folks who are ideologically opposed to me are thinking about and talking about this stuff. And every now and then I learn something important. And we should talk with our neighbors. I work with a lot of very conservative folks in the Bakersfield community. And one of the things that's most telling to me is we do share the same values. And the more we connect over, as Joe put it, the emotional and the moral component of our lives together, the easier it is for us to ignore just how big the inauguration was.
I take your point, and I take it, and just to really sum up, there seems you've got, okay, there's structural reforms that we can make, yeah, legal reforms that we can make, but mostly structural reforms. And then there's changes in us. That thing you said, patience, yeah, right? Yeah. Patience is grand, but politics is mostly impatient. Politics is about the fierce urgency of now, right? And I feel this fierce urgency from my side. So I don't know how you get, preach patience to people who are political, who feel marginalized and on this and that, and they want their story out and they want change now, and they don't want to listen to the person who says, wait.
Yeah, so patience doesn't imply it's going to be easy. The marketplace gets messy in a whole bunch of ways. And unfortunately, that marketplace also sometimes motivates violence, as we're seeing now. And I don't think that's going to get better anytime soon. But we will cycle out of it. You know, that's not meant to disvalue those who will face harms over these next, right, 4 years, hopefully, maybe a year and a half.
Let me throw something else at you. This is both to you and Josh, because I know you're both a fan of Mill. I'm a fan of Mill, too. I tell students to read Mill, understand Mill. I'm a fan of Mill. But there's something I think he missed, and I think it's relevant to, not as journalism, but it's partly relevant to journalism, but also political discourse in general. One of the things that I think Mill did not appreciate enough is the role of power in controlling what speech gets heard, what speech gets certified as, you know, worthy of attention, mm-hmm, needing an argument, and power, when you marry power and you give certain people kind of primary or exclusive access to the means of public representation, it all gets distorted, and the free marketplace of ideas is a sham.
Yeah, so that's part of the reason why the fairness doctrine is so troubling, because the power that goes behind who owns those airwaves, who has access to your AM radio station, that structural condition allows for some voices to be heard and not others. Ruth Bader Ginsburg was asked once, if you could change anything about the Constitution, what would you do? And she said, I would add more positive rights, particularly with respect to the First Amendment. We have to provide mechanisms for people's voices to be heard and give that constitutional protection. An argument similar to Catherine McKinnon made and any number of folks currently making from the identity politics perspective.
So there is this issue about objectivity and some people think journalists have abandoned objectivity. What do you think? Is objectivity a good thing? An impossible thing? Were journalists right? Have they abandoned objectivity? Let's talk about objectivity a little bit.
So I'm going to do the classic philosopher move and throw it back at you. What do you mean by objectivity?
I don't know. People spend their whole lives thinking about it. I mean something like this. We have our beliefs, right? And here's the thing. Believing it so doesn't make it so, right? And when I believe something, I have an obligation to try and check my belief against the world. Right, to push it as hard as possible from all angles, against all evidence, and so your authority doesn't generate truth. Just you gotta push your beliefs against the world. You're not entitled. You're entitled to any opinion, but you're not entitled to any belief. Something like that is what I mean.
Yeah, so I certainly agree with that. I actually have a bumper sticker on my car that says, don't believe everything you think.
Right.
We do have, I'm with Clifford on this, we do have a moral obligation because most of our beliefs lead to action and our actions have consequences for others. So we do have an obligation to try to get it as right as possible. I also firmly believe that we approach our interactions with the world and particularly our interactions with other people through our own value lens. And journalists, of course, are doing that as well. But I'm enough of a pragmatist to know that if I'm coming up with something crazy, the world's going to push back.
Right.
Either, right, you know, some kind of physical realism is going to push back, or all the people around me are going to recognize I'm a nut job and they're no longer going to pay attention to me. They're no longer going to give me credibility.
Yeah, Lippmann wrote about this. He talked about the ideas in our head, the pictures in our head. Yeah. We kind of live in these pictures in our head, but we act in the world, and we go on with our little blithe pictures in our head. But the world has a way. It's hard. The world has a way of embarrassing us, and bringing it. But our pictures in our head can cause all kinds of damage. They can cause wars. They can cause misguided wars based on thought rather than fact. Okay. Making the pictures of your head match reality, Lippmann, is really, really hard. How can journalism be structured so that we don't just run wild with the pictures in our head, but, you know, they bump up? How can journalism help us do that?
Yeah, so journalism is necessarily going to be approaching particularly human events, the most complex of these kinds of stories, from their point of view. And I know that the New York Times is going to approach it in one way. I know KALW is going to approach it in a different way. And it's part of my responsibility to get outside my bubble and make sure that I'm seeing different takes on that same event.
Right. So, but it's not, it seems to me we can go beyond just, well, we're getting different takes. That's one way to think about it. So you read a variety of news sources. But even within one news source, surely there's a difference between news and fake news. I mean, surely the world bumps up against us, as you were saying. We can't have mathematical standards of proof. But, you know, we can have preponderance of the evidence. We can go to the best sources. We can gather as much evidence as possible. We can interview a number of people, and we can make good arguments, sound arguments. So it seems to me, can't we even within one news source insist on certain standards, even if those standards don't rise to the level of sort of 100% certainty?
Yeah, so those are the traditional standards of good journalism, right? That you go to experts that are genuine experts. And there's a pretty strong movement in academic journalism these days for what's called a scientific approach to journalism, looking for those standards of evidence. The huge problem that journalism is facing is the monetary pushes. Newspapers are losing money. There was a brief uptick after the election, and they were starting to hire again. We're starting to see that turn back down. If we move into another recession soon, they're going to lose their advertising dollars. So there's just not enough reporters out there having enough time to do that kind of work that you're describing. That's why it's up to us to go to multiple sources.
Yeah, one last really quick thought. Agree or disagree? It's the financial thing is one, but we've also lost confidence in these standards.
The distrust of journalism has been dominant for the last 15 years. Happily, it kicked back up again about 9 months ago, 10 months ago, and it's certainly at a better place than it was 10 years ago.
Yeah, well, on that optimistic note, Christopher, I'm going to thank you for joining us. It's been a great conversation.
I've really enjoyed it. Thank you very much.
Our guest has been Christopher Myers. He's a professor of philosophy at Cal State Bakersfield, editor of A Philosophical Approach to Journalism Ethics. So, Josh, you got a closing last thought?
Well, man, I guess we've all got work to do, right? I mean, journalists need to recommit to public, to performing a public service. Consumers have to support them financially. Consumers, also regular folk like us, we have to go talk to our neighbors, read multiple sources of news. Politicians need to restore the fairness doctrine. I mean, that's maybe a long shot. And maybe intellectuals also need to do their work, right?
Yeah,
double
really,
down on truth. Resist the BS.
You're really big on I join you. You're really big on the responsibility of intellectuals. So thinkers out there, take up the banner of truth. This conversation continues at Philosopher's Corner at our online community of thinkers, where our motto is cogito ergo blogo, I think, therefore I blog. And if you have a question that wasn't addressed on today's show, we'd love to hear from you still. Send your question to us at comments@philosophytalk.org, and we might just feature it on our blog.
You can become a partner in the community by visiting our website, philosophytalk.org. Now let's hear from the voice of truth, past, present, and future. It's Ian Scholes, the 60-Second Philosopher.
Ian Scholes, what is fake news? Let's put it in perspective. Fake news is real news in Metropolis. If you read the Daily Planet, you would believe Lois Lane and Clark Kent, especially when it came to the comings and goings of Superman, about whom the Daily Planet seemed to have an inside track. Of course, we, in the real world, know that the Daily Planet had an unfair advantage over its competitors. Did Metropolis even have a rival newspaper? Well, yes. In the early days of the Superman mythos, Lex Luthor owned all the media in Metropolis except the Daily Planet. He used the media to control his image as a wealthy benefactor, kind of like Bruce Wayne, I guess, over in Gotham City. So when Clark Kent went to work for the failing, as our president might put it, Daily Planet, it suddenly got scoops, exclusives about Superman, increasing circulation, leading to resentment from Lex Luthor against the media that continues to this day. Kind of like Donald Trump. Anyway, it became moot. The Daily Planet newspaper, as in real life, became less and less important. And eventually, in the comics, Clark Kent was given a new job as a news anchor, which seems a waste of his unique reporting skills, you know, super hearing, ability to fly, X-ray vision, etc. I did not see the Zack Snyder-directed Batman vs. Superman movie because life is too short, but I understand Clark was back at the newspaper being a hard-hitting reporter in that one, trying to dig up dirt on Batman for some stupid reason. Why didn't he just take his X-ray vision over to Gotham City and look for himself? At the very least, take a look at Wayne Plaza, Wayne Towers, Wayne 1 Stadium. Come on, there's some kind of corruption going on over there. I don't know how journalism even works in genre pictures anymore. I've seen more than one movie where an intrepid journalist was a blogger. Oh yeah, those blogs really strike fear into the hearts of evildoers. The real problem in the real world, fake news-wise, is that nobody believes anything on the internet, or everybody believes everything. No middle ground at all. Thinking back, one of the early examples of fake news is the Orson Welles radio production of War of the Worlds, which was presented as a kind of phone newscast and supposedly caused panic all across the U.S. Well, it turns out that wasn't true. There was no mass hysteria. Not that many people were even listening to it, because it was up against the Edgar Bergen program, the inexplicably popular radio ventriloquist. Incidents of panic were made up by newspapers who were experiencing a big loss of readership because people were getting the news from the radio. Also, there's a lot of concern, like now, over the rising popularity of racist rabble-rousers like Father Coughlin. And a fake panic over a radio show gave fodder to those who wanted to put a muzzle on radio expression, like the production code in movies and the comics code in comics. When it came along and took over, television was even scarier. I can't even watch television news. You get self-important anchors surrounded by blinking banners and scrolling text blurbing breaking news and upcoming segments. You get tables full of men in blue suits and some women finding ways to not have cautious opinions about momentous events. This used to be called spin. Now it is called framing the narrative. It just makes me nervous. I prefer the soothing voices of public radio, unless they're warning about Martian invaders. As far as fake news goes, near as I can tell, that actually means news Donald Trump doesn't like. Well, maybe he can't, but I can certainly live with it. I gotta go.
Philosophy Talk is a presentation of KALW, local public radio San Francisco, and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University, copyright 2017.
Our executive producers are David Demarest and Matt Martin.
Our senior producer is Devin Strolovich. Laura McGuire is our director of research. Cindy Prince-Baum is our director of marketing.
Thanks also to Merle Kessler, Audrey Dilling, and Colin Peden.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from various groups at Stanford University and from the partners at our online community of thinkers.
The views expressed or misexpressed in this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our other funders, not even when they're true and reasonable.
The conversation continues on our website, philosophytalk.org, where you, too, can become a partner in our community of thinkers. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.
What about the breathing, the panting, the moaning, the screaming?
Fake, 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 fake.